Hello, you're listening to CGLO 1690 AM. This is Tales of Entomology, your favorite history slash insect show. I'm Lucy, I'm a medieval historian.
And I'm Martin, an entomologist. I also have a cold. Today's show is about the mosquito.
Who also happens to be the world's deadliest animal. It's hard to get an accurate statistic of how many people die each year because of mosquitoes, because there are many different causes of death.
But a number we've seen a lot spread around the internet is a million. So imagine that. 1 million people die because of mosquitoes every year. So how exactly do mosquitoes manage to do in so many of us?
You've probably already guessed. They are carriers of disease. Diseases like dengue fever, West Nile virus, chikungunya, Zika, yellow fever, and the big one,
malaria.
Malaria, which kills nearly 500,000 people each year and has been plaguing us since antiquity.
But before we go on about death and neurological issues, Lucy.
Yes.
Pop quiz. Which insect do you think a mosquito is most closely related to?
A dragonfly, a wasp, or a housefly? Is that what you want to ask me?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you.
Well, I'm not sure. They really don't look alike. But I know, for preparing for this show, that mosquitoes were called gnats in the Middle Ages. So I would say that they look like the housefly, maybe.
Golly, Lucy. Yes, exactly. It's the mosquito. They're the most related to houseflies. The only thing they have in common with wasps and dragonflies is that they're all insects. Houseflies and mosquitoes, as well as midges and gnats or gnats and crane flies, are all part of the order of insects called Diptera. Mosquito actually means little fly in Spanish and Portuguese.
Incidentally, while some insects like the dragonfly or the mayfly have the word fly in them, they are not considered true flies. The addition of fly in their name is only used here to mean that they are tiny things that fly.
So while houseflies are big, hairy, and kind of meaty, and mosquitoes look like they could barely find their way out of a raindrop, they both share one particular characteristic that tells us that they and all other true flies came from the same ancestor. And it's something about their wings. Those annoying, annoying wings. All right, let's try the
magic sound effect. Okay, we're trying to just play the sound of a mosquito.
That would have been great.
We are going to manage. Is it working somehow?
No, because I don't know where. Okay, whatever.
Okay, so we are very sorry. It's been the fourth show and we're still trying to do that and we just can't. So yeah, most insects like bees, wasps, dragonflies, and even beetles and butterflies have four wings.
Yeah, and there are others like the fleas and lice which have no wings at all.
But Diptera only have two wings, like the mosquitoes. Hence the name Diptera. D means two in Greek, and ptera is the word for wing. They used to have hind wings. They now have halters, which look like very tiny spoons.
And these halters act like gyroscopes, helping the flies to detect changes in body positioning, which is pretty neat.
Sure, but mosquitoes would be much neater if they were not as annoying.
And potentially deadly.
Now, even if they all look the same from our vantage point, there are actually around 3,500 species of mosquitoes, which is way too many in my opinion. And as we mentioned earlier, a good number of these species can carry bacteria, viruses, and parasites that cause disease in humans.
So species from the Culex genus are vectors of encephalitis, filariasis, and the West Nile virus.
And there are also the species of the Aedes genus, which comes from the ancient Greek word for odious. And they can spread dengue fever, yellow fever, the Zika virus, chikungunya, encephalitis, and elephantitis.
And many species from the Anopheles genus, from the ancient Greek word for useless.
I just love this.
Carry the unicellular parasite that causes malaria.
We don't often think of malaria in the West. It's kind of the disease that happens in other countries, the ones you have to get vaccinated to go visit, or that people who work for Doctors Without Borders hassle you about when you exit the metro.
So according to the World Health Organization, there were 219 million malaria cases worldwide in 2017 and 435,000 deaths from malaria in that same year.
So what is malaria? There are five different types of single-cell parasites that induce different forms of malaria in humans. All these parasites are categorized in the Plasmodium genus. Regardless of the type of malaria, the initial symptoms are very flu-like. Headache, fever, shivering, joint pain, vomiting. This can appear from 7 days after the infected mosquito bite to several months after.
And now, what is specific to malaria and to the different forms of malaria is the pattern of intermittent fevers. These fevers come back and forth, manifesting as sudden coldness followed by shivering and then fever and sweating. Depending on the type of malaria, the fevers can occur every 24 hours, 48 hours, or 72 hours.
Most cases of malaria are relatively benign. But in serious cases, there can be seizures, mental confusion, kidney failure, respiratory distress, coma, and then death.
And that's because the parasites reproduce in your red blood cells and actually change their structure so that they get stuck in your blood vessels. And this hides them from your immune system and allows them to reproduce like crazy. The buildup of infected and stuck blood cells leads to anemia, which is when your body lacks enough healthy red blood cells to carry oxygen to your tissues. This can damage tissues in your heart, your lungs, spleen, liver, and in your brain.
Even if you recover from a disease episode, of which there can be more than one, you could be left with permanent neurological damage. So anyone suspected of having malaria should receive immediate care because their condition could deteriorate quickly and unpredictably.
And humans have had to deal with this for a very long time. 4,700 years ago, the oldest known medical book, which is the Huang Di Nei Jing, or the Yellow Emperor's Classic of Medicine, refers to malaria. And Egyptian texts from 4,000 years ago describe cyclical fevers that were most likely malaria. And again, Indian sources from 3,500 years ago called the disease jungle fever, marsh fever, or swamp fever, and connected it to the onset of the rain season and with the bite of mosquitoes.
But the name malaria that we commonly use actually has European roots. In Western culture, it was believed that certain diseases, such as malaria or the plague, were caused by miasma, which is a word from ancient Greek signifying pollution or defilement. It's a poisonous vapor filled with particles from decomposed matter, miasmata. Hippocrates, the father of Western medicine, discussed the symptoms of the disease in books he wrote circa 400 before the Common Era. Hippocrates called malaria marsh fevers, tertian fevers, cotton fevers, or intermittent fevers, terms that are still used today to distinguish between different forms of malaria. He also noted that malaria occurred primarily in spring and summer in areas nearing stagnant waters.
And so the term malaria was probably coined in the early 15th century. It's found in the History of Florence, written by Leonardo Bruni, who talks about the disease of the bad air, or the mala aria, contracted to malaria. The term malaria came into usage in England in the 18th century.
Before then, as I just mentioned, it was called tertian fever or cotton fever. But the bad air or miasma theory of malaria remained an accepted hypothesis from the 4th century before the Common Era until about midway through the 19th century, when mosquitoes were finally identified as the transmitting agents of malaria. The bad air theory was established on accurate observations. There is malaria where there is stagnant waters. And another thing that people knew was that mosquitoes hang out near water.
Albertus Magnus, or Albert the Great, a famous philosopher of the 13th century who believed that little boys got fleas from eating figs, writes that mosquitoes arise chiefly in damp areas and consequently are most abundant near bodies of water, which was a pretty decent observation. So let's talk about mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes lay their eggs singly or in rafts at the water's surface. Or they can lay them near the water and they hatch when there's a flood.
Depending on the species, the hatched larvae, which are apparently also called wrigglers, then live in ponds, pools, water collected in artificial containers or in tree holes, among many other places. The larvae become pupa, which is the phase where they transform into adults. And then they become adults and ruin our camping trips.
As most people know, only female mosquitoes bite. They need the protein to produce and lay eggs. The males, but also the females sometimes, feed on nectar and other plant juices. The males typically live only for a few days, while the females live for a couple of weeks and up to over a month in captivity. They feed, digest, mate, and lay eggs, and do it all over again until they die.
So, what do mosquitoes look like? Let's go back to Albert the Great for a second. He describes mosquitoes as follows. Mosquitoes are flying insects endowed with long legs. They're tiny, fly-like creatures with a beak mounted on the head with which they pierce human skin.
That's as good a description as we need to give you on the show. You've all seen them a million times, usually just right before you splattered them and your blood on your arm.
And the only thing that he got wrong is that they don't actually have a beak. Let's remember that the microscope was only invented in the 17th century. They actually have what's called an elongated proboscis, which is a sting-like mouth thing that they use to pierce through plants or skin.
So when they sting us, they actually spit in us before they start sucking blood, which is absolutely delightful. Their spit is anticoagulant, which makes sure the blood won't clot while they suck it up. Our bodies recognize the foreign substance and send blood over to the puncture, which is what creates that red bump that itches so much.
And so the saliva is how diseases get transmitted into our blood. Most of these pathogens have evolved to look for and stay in the salivary glands whenever they find themselves in mosquitoes. Well, how do they choose their victims? Some people complain that they're mosquito magnets, right? While others can spend the whole weekend at the chalet without a single bite. Our favorite medieval authors have an explanation.
Albertus Magnus, or Albert the Great, writes that, and I quote, "Mosquitoes are attracted by the moist vapors that emanate from animal bodies, especially from humans. This is the reason they fly in the evening and make a beeline for the heads of persons who are perspiring."
And a century later, some bourgeois from Paris writes in The Good Wife's Guide that, "I have witnessed often in different places that once people go to bed, the rooms fill with mosquitoes attracted by the breath of the sleepers. The insects land on their faces and sting them."
It is true that mosquitoes are more active at night and at dawn, and I'm sure you've all noticed that. The reason why Albert the Great and the Parisian bourgeois mention perspiration, moist vapors, and breath is because the mosquito is a swamp and marsh creature. In medieval philosophy, it makes sense to assert that this insect is attracted to environments similar to where they came from, namely moist and vaporous emanations. Here, perspiration and breath.
And while perspiration and vaporous emanations are pretty good guesses, they're actually not too far from the truth. According to what scientists have discovered so far, mosquitoes are adapted so they can smell CO2. Carbon dioxide, for those who might not know. They can smell it from nearly 50 meters away. And they're generally attracted to people who exhale more CO2, so adults and generally bigger people.
At a closer range, they can detect substances like lactic acid and ammonia from your sweat, and they are attracted to higher body temperatures. So people who have exerted themselves or with certain genetic predispositions tend to stand out.
But despite what some studies and what anecdotal evidence have said, which is that, you know, things like beer, bananas, type O blood, or being pregnant and wearing dark clothes can make you more attractive to mosquitoes, there really isn't that much hard evidence to support that. So whatever is attracting them to us, there's one thing that people in all the centuries of history can agree on, which is that mosquitoes are annoying. So how do we protect ourselves from their bite and get rid of them?
According to our best friend Albert the Great, or Albertus Magnus, it's easy, and today it's my favorite quote of the day. If a house or living area is plagued by mosquitoes, he wrote, fumigation by burning dried elephant dung will cause the insects to flee. So another option, certainly more doable in places deprived of elephants, reads as follows. It is commonly believed if a horsehair is tacked to a door sill, it will prevent the entry of mosquitoes into the house through the doorway. More commonly, Albertus notes, people living in mosquito-infected areas install nettings around their beds to prevent mosquitoes from feeding on them during the night.
And then in ancient Egypt, people living in marshlands tried to build their houses at higher elevations to get the wind to blow through their houses, which I suppose could work well if the area is well drained, there aren't any puddles collecting, and there's a really strong wind. All in all, mosquitoes are just pretty darn hard to get rid of.
What ended up working very, very well to fight back mosquitoes is an actual very recent invention, which is DDT, a compound used in pesticides, which was used heavily in World War II and in the following decades for agriculture. It's too bad that a chemical which is toxic for insects also ended up being toxic for higher order wildlife, and for humans as well. It is also worth mentioning that large-scale use of DDT led to populations of mosquitoes in many regions developing resistance to DDT.
Obviously, scientists took exception to that, and DDT was eventually banned in the States, in Canada, and in many other countries. And so since the 90s, DEET, D-E-E-T, took up the slack, and even though DDT is still used in some developing countries. So DEET is an insect repellent. It doesn't kill them like DDT, but at least it can give you a certain respite. While it's still somewhat toxic, it hasn't been shown to bioaccumulate in living things like DDT does. To bioaccumulate means that when a substance accumulates in an organism faster than that organism can evacuate it. And while DEET works pretty well, I used it to do my field work up in Abitibi, and it was my savior. And citronella candles don't work at all.
But DDT and DEET are not solely responsible for why malaria is not considered relatively rare in Europe and North America compared to with South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia. In Europe, swamps and marshes, however filled with bad and putrid air, were widely recognized as beneficial areas up to the 16th century. Local populations fished and hunted, they harvested wood and reeds. They were used to cohabiting with mosquitoes, even though many actually happened to die of malaria.
Paris was, for instance, very swampy up to the early modern era when draining infrastructures were built to dry out the city. Everywhere in Western Europe, from Italy to the Low Countries, from England to France, the drainage of marshes and swamps was undertaken in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries.
The impetus for draining the swamps was manifold. First, the putrid air theory had gained tremendous leverage. Many scientists claimed that it was an issue of public health. They said that people who lived near swamps and marshes were feeble and mentally challenged due to the nasty vapors.
And second, population expansion called for the conquest and settlement of lands. Making inhospitable areas more hospitable enabled the settlement of larger communities.
More people means more people to feed. Marshes and swamps were dried out to cultivate cereals such as wheat and to create pastures for cattle. So swamps were drained. Mosquitoes left, and malaria declined accordingly. By the end of the 19th century, malaria was basically a relatively rare disease in Western Europe and in North America.
But it persists in the world to this day, and as we mentioned at the start of the episode, malaria claims hundreds of thousands of lives every year. And that's not counting the number of deaths caused by all the other diseases spread by mosquitoes.
So what do we do? We cannot drain all the swamps, obviously, although Trump would love that. In recent years, some scientists have made the case for just completely eradicating mosquitoes.
Maybe not all of them. Of the 3,500 species of mosquitoes that we've identified so far, only about 100 of them spread human disease. Geneticists today have techniques that allow them to alter DNA in living cells. That means that it would be theoretically possible to insert infertility mutations into lab-grown mosquitoes and then release them into the wild.
While it's impossible to completely control an open system like, for instance, the entire planet, such a strategy has the potential to eradicate vectors of disease from nature one species at a time. But the real question is, do we actually understand the ramifications of this approach? Who can make that decision to eradicate a species?
In the tundra, mosquitoes are an important source of food for birds. But in other regions, biologists think that the ecosystems could actually survive the loss, though we can't really know. We can't know, for instance, about all the micro-interactions that happen in an ecosystem. The presence of one species can often suppress another. Eliminate one, and we might create the conditions for potentially a bigger menace to prosper.
So while the argument can be made that we would be saving millions of human lives, and the idea of not having any mosquitoes around may sound quite lovely, we might sow the seeds of an even greater disaster.
So while there are many more interesting facts about mosquitoes and malaria, well, we couldn't fit it all into one half-hour episode. So we'll leave it at that and wish you all a happy Monday. And because we kind of messed up with all the sound thing today, we're going to end it with the Mosquito Song by Queens of the Stone Age. So tune in next week at 2 p.m. We'll talk about forensic entomology. Still on CJLO 1690 AM. Goodbye.
Goodbye.